Thank you for listening to this Podcast One production.
Now available on Apple Podcasts,
Podcast One, Spotify, and anywhere else you get your podcasts.
All right, sports fans, Podcast One has two great new shows for you to check out. Seven-time NBA champ Robert Horry is bringing big guests and great NBA commentary on the Big Shot Bob Pod.
The Brooklyn Nets remind me of Oklahoma Sooner football, and we got to have to outscore you every time, and that's what the Brooklyn Nets are.
Man, you got Steve Nash at the helm. You got D'Antoni. They ain't thinking about no defense.
And Eric Bolling and Brett Favre come together for Bowling with Favre. Everything from sports to politics to business and culture.
Any insight on what Aaron plans to do in Green Bay?
What I read into his comments were simply frustration. Nothing more than that.
Subscribe now to the Big Shot Bob Pod and Bowling with Favre on the Podcast One app, Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And rate and review the shows on Apple for your chance to be featured.
Welcome to Real GM Radio. I am Danny Lurie, your host, and so happy to have you with us for this episode. My guest is Seth Partnow, my colleague at The Athletic, and one of my favorite people to talk to about where the sport is and where it's going. And we start out with a conversation on something he wrote about recently, which was defensive shot quality, which is something I find really interesting, part of his shot quality series for The Athletic. And then we got into title contenders, buyers and sellers at the trade deadline, the awesome analytics conference that he is going to be involved in that's coming up later this week. We'll have plenty of details on that, both in Seth's section and at the end. So lots of good conversation, a little bit on the shorter side. It's about 40 minutes, but lots of great stuff in here. Hope you really enjoy it. Thanks so much for coming on.
Pleasure as always, Danny.
The place I want to start is you wrote a really interesting piece for The Athletic. I think it was about a week ago, continuing your shot quality series, talking about defensive shot quality, which is I end up fixating, I think, more often on offensive shot quality, but defensive shot quality is insanely important in terms of projecting how teams are going to succeed and also what success is sustainable.
I actually think defensive shot quality is more important than kind of offensive shot quality. I wouldn't say that. It's not more important, but you can tell much more about a team's offense just by looking at how well they're shooting than you can about a team's defense by looking at how opponents are shooting. So you need to understand the process a little better on the defensive side to get a handle on a team. And so I think it is maybe more instructive. There's a number of reasons for that. Number one is that, you know, shot quality is sort of an aggregate stat, and the highest quality shots for any given team are shots that players on that team can make, and that changes for a team. So a team could be taking quote unquote bad shots that are fine shots for them, but if a team is giving up good shots, it kind of doesn't matter who they're playing against. Eventually, sorry, Knicks fans.
Well, yeah, and the idea that if a defense is trying to stop and concede certain shots, you get the offensive variance, which makes a lot of sense. So basically the idea is that you'll have some teams that have great three-point shooters, you'll have some teams that have bad three-point shooters. And it's not necessarily true over 20 games or over 40 games, but over 72, 82, not always. I mean, there's always variance in terms of, like, what a team's opponent three-point shooting percentage is. But the idea is that a lot of that stuff comes out once you kind of minimize variance by increasing the sample. Is that correct?
Yeah, both that and also you can sort of balance your opponents. You can go on a pretty good defensive run by playing five teams in a row that can't shoot.
Yeah, it's a great point. Well, and that's what the thing that you talked about with Jason Quick was, right? Like that the Blazers had been looking a lot better defensively, and it's become partially because they were playing worse teams.
They were playing worse shooting teams, and it's not saying they played bad defense, but you play certain groups of teams, and it's a great recipe to get your defense healthy.
Yeah, that's a really good point, and it's challenging, I'm sure, this year for, you know, models and everything like that because because there isn't necessarily internal consistency. So then, like, let's say, okay, I don't know if you want to use, like, the Wizards or what.
Pick a team.
Yeah, any team that in that specific game, their shooter quality might be dramatically different than the season on the aggregate or last season.
Right. So, I mean, looking at it more, you also can look at who, like, specifically who has taken shots, not just the teams they've played against. But, yeah, if you're doing, like a quick and dirty analysis, oh, they've played the five worst shooting teams in the league. Of course they play. Their defense has been good the last five games. That generally speaking, will hold.
Yeah, and that makes a lot of sense. And then one of the other elements that I've tried to convey, and this is actually some good news for Knicks fans. I've been skeptical of various elements of their defense, is that broadly speaking, defenses can affect an opponent's success rate more the closer you get to the basket. That is very good news for Rudy Gobert and the Jazz. That is very bad news for other teams. And I think, like, so if we're going to use the Knicks as a prism, at least for this little bit, that is a good piece of news for them, because I think that they are, when healthy, a pretty reliable rim-protecting team.
I mean, Mitchell Robinson and Nerlens Noel. Those players are probably not as good overall, quote unquote, rim protectors as kind of some of their block numbers would indicate.
That makes me go back to that old rim protection, that thing that you had back in the nylon calculus days. Wasn't that part of the idea?
Yeah, a block shot is sort of a binary, but you know, how many shots does Rudy Gobert make teams that don't have Zion Williamson miss without actually touching them because they're, you know, trying to contort themselves to avoid him? Whereas, you know, a bad rim protector, a guy's just like powering up and shooting a layup and maybe he misses it, but probably not. Maybe an Enes Kanter gets a fingertip on it from time to time, but for the most part, he's not really affecting the guy, what the guy wants to do with the ball.
Right, and so I think that's a difference for block shots versus steals. I mean, part of it was I was coming up, you know, the first team I covered regularly with a credential was those early 2010s Golden State Warriors with Monte Ellis, who was one of the ultimate examples of, like, steals are not a reliably positive stat, because you can be, I mean, they can be, obviously. A steal is the best defensive outcome for a possession. But if the way you get there is by gambling 10 times and getting one of them, then you're right, creating a lot of good opportunities. And a block is not that extreme, but it doesn't necessarily reflect, it is not as good a reflection of what you're trying to quantify and discuss than you want it to be. Like, you do not, this guy, because he blocks 5% more shots a game, does not mean he is the best rim protector. It means he blocks 5% more shots a game.
Right. I think the first time this was pointed out was, I think, early in David Robinson's career, and someone noted that the opponent 2-point percentage that Spurs opponent shots in, like, games Robinson played versus those he didn't. And it was like, yeah, he's blocking two of them, but they're missing 10 extra shots a game. What's going on there? And so just, you know, inducing those misses is really what the defense is about. And really, like, forcing a miss without blocking it is almost better, because a block tends to end up out of bounds and they get the ball back. So in some ways, it's almost better to force a miss without blocking it. Although, you know, obviously a shot with a 0% chance of going in is a good outcome for the defense.
Yeah, it absolutely is. And that gets into something that can sometimes be hard to reconcile, especially when you consider that there is a third factor here, which we'll talk about, which is rim frequency versus rim success. So the idea basically being, like, deterrence versus actually, like, them going up and making it. But then I want to mention the third factor, because this is something that has come up a little bit, and I don't have the statistical sophistication to get all the way to this, is that sometimes when teams are so zealous about protecting against the rim, you think about, well, one of the ways that teams can get there is through transition. And let's say, I mean, there are obviously, you know, getting back and all these other things, ways that teams can affect how much their opponents get shots around the basket in transition, unless you're facing the Denver Nuggets in that last couple seconds of that Washington game. And that is a real challenge for me sometimes, is, and correct me if I'm wrong, but, like, that if theoretically, let's say you're super zealous about protecting the rim, that means a higher proportion of the opponent's rim attempts are coming in transition, which are not necessarily they're reflective of something, but it's not the same thing.
Yeah, no, I think that's it. That's an interesting point. If you're rarely giving up half court rim attempts, it is probable that a higher proportion of opponent rim attempts are coming in transition, which are, you know, tend to be pretty high value. So
could
again,
could that be enough to really affect the numbers based on the way they're kind of disseminated now?
That's a good question. There's a similar effect I've wondered about, you know, for transition in half court in other kind of situations, and I've never really found the effect that I think is theoretically possible. So I don't know, but I'm skeptical it would be that much. So maybe, but I would, my intuition would be not so much.
I don't want to dwell on it. I think you and I may have discussed on the podcast before. We've definitely discussed it outside of it before. Part of the challenge of, and this is a challenge that might be a temporary one, we'll have to see, of quantifying some of this stuff is that it does rely on, let's call it the human element. And what I mean by that is like logging and tracking of shots. This is something you got into a little bit in the piece in terms of you ended up grouping kind of the everything under 10 feet into one group. And I think part of that was because it's nice to think about at the rim and away from the rim as totally different things. And it's, you know, there are some dispositive value in that. However, that relies on the person who, because it's humans logging them, marking it quote unquote correctly. And that can lead to some real variance too.
Well, no, actually the reason I did that is that's how the data is available on NBA.
Yes. It's still so true though. I mean,
yeah, no. And so that, so there's actually kind of two different things that are going on here. Like the data that I'm using on NBA.com to really get into the shot quality stuff, which includes, you know, defensive pressure and shot clock time and number of dribbles before the shot and stuff like that. That's all derived from practice, from tracking data. And so that kind of, while there is some sort of interesting stuff kind of closer to the basket on how far was this shot taken from, those sort of determinations, well, this was a 4-footer versus a 2-footer based on where I placed the stylus on the courtside entry system. We don't have that problem in tracking data. Now in kind of what we're more used to seeing in data that comes up in like shot charts and stuff like that, that is absolutely, an issue that comes into play. And as I, we're recording this on Tuesday, as I wrote about today, you know, there appear to be some significant arena effects in terms of some scorekeepers are more inclined to call shots a little closer to the rim than others. And it doesn't matter, like the shot still goes in or it doesn't. But when doing analysis, it can really, like, you know, a big swing in that can kind of change, you know, your evaluation of the process, I guess.
Yeah. And an analog in the kind of scoring vagaries is certain arenas, certain scorekeepers are more willing to be flexible on what counts as an assist. You know, like I think back to the Chris Paul New Orleans one. I think that was a notoriously generous scorekeeper. And that, as you said, like it's whether the basket goes in or not, but it is an element of statistical credit, which if it is not an assist, even like, and also, of course, there are assists that are larger value added than others, but it gets into the idea of like, sometimes the quick and easy quantifications are really nice, but it's not necessarily sufficiently complete.
Yeah. And this is also, I think this is of a different sort of, there was an element of kind of gassing your guy up to, yep, to those kind of hometown assists. I don't think like what I'm talking about with the shot locations is that.
Right.
I think it's just like one scorekeeper is maybe as simple as sitting at a different angle to the play.
Yeah, or like
one arena
or where they take off from versus where they shoot from.
Yeah.
I'm sure that could,
yeah,
be a challenge in a lot of these. Like,
yeah,
like if you did it on takeoff point, a lot of shots around the basket would actually be labeled as a little bit further away, because if you jump, like, these players are amazing athletes, like they can jump from further out and get it
no,
around the basket.
So this is like figuring out where a shot is taken from for a player like jumping toward the basket is actually something that has been kind of hard to totally pin down in tracking data. Like it's something that's kind of constantly under revision. And, you know, there were times as of, you know, a couple of years ago where, like, Giannis took a lot of 8-foot layups. You know, a guy who moves very quickly to the basket has very long arms. Like, you know, like where you're measuring that shot, like there's no right or wrong answer. But it's, and especially if you're trying to do something algorithmic that, like, you know, an edge case is going to break something that is designed to fit most players. So there was,
yeah, and it's also interesting because though you could think about those shots being fundamentally different based on like closest defender and all these other things. Like if you take off from 8 feet, but there's somebody there, then maybe you're taking more of a floater runner. If you're taking off from 8 feet and there's no one there, Giannis can be dunking. Like that is a really interesting distinction too.
Yeah. And well, also it's Giannis. So he's okay. He's dunking.
Yeah. That's true.
So it's,
but if it, but so, let's say yeah. it's, I don't know, somebody less explosive, then it becomes a different ballgame. Like let's say it's Monte Morris. Like a Monte Morris right. 4 foot shot is going to look different whether there if there is a person there or not.
Yeah, no, I mean it's the difference between like a contorting layup and just kind of a backhand to the rim finger roll.
Well, and that gets into the other funny thing about how things are logged that who was that? Was that Crumple Jumper who had the thing about basically like the longer the description, the more likely the shot is to go in?
Oh no, that's something that we've noted for a long time. That was first. I'll take credit for that. Back in I think that was around 2013 on Nylon Calculus. Kind of it was decided that this was even before he became famous for the step back jumper. But like James Harden was supposedly shooting like 60% on step back threes that year, which meant he was shooting like 60%. Like he had made some high percentage of a low number of attempts, and on just like normal three pointers, he was shooting like in the low 30s. It's like, so why does he just not jump backwards every time he shoots if he's so much better at it? Or there's something strange going on with the logging, and it's for any number of reasons, the shot gets noted as being fancier when it goes in than oftentimes.
To me, the most straightforward one is that if the shot doesn't go in, there's more work for that logger to do.
Yep. No, that there's that also. You don't have as much time because there's a rebound. There's maybe an offensive rebound, maybe a foul, and you have to plug in a bunch of different things in a short span of time.
Yeah, that's a really good point. I liked in the piece something that you did was you in the piece from last week, you did the shot quality one. You talked about where things were at kind of like the halfway point of last year. And so kind of, like the teams that defy, like, so that the Nuggets last year were kind of where the Knicks are right now.
Yeah. And this, it's not something that it's not a rubber band.
Sure.
If the Knicks are not going to, the Knicks are no likely to be to be the kind of the unluckiest team on opponent 3-point shooting in the second half of the season as they are to be as lucky kind of in the second half as they were in the first half. But those are still, both of those outcomes are still pretty unlikely. And the expectation is kind of neutral. But what can happen is you can see those huge swings that don't necessarily have much correlation to any underlying kind of process. It's just the shots are going in, and they weren't before, and that happens.
Yeah, I think the rubber band part of this warrants a little bit more of explanation. I think it's a really interesting idea, which is I was thinking about it. There was Dan Szymborski he was going through his favorite emails, and somebody was sending something about David Wright, and like David Wright was well below his projected OPS at that point, and they're like, well, so he's obviously going to be like, he's going to have an OPS that's like triple the normal thing so he could get to that expected number. It's like, that's not necessarily the way this works.
No, it's regression to the mean is not like a rubber band that snaps back. It just means that you're going to approach your true kind of level as you the rest of your attempts are kind of completed at that level. So you still have that, it's just like a team that gets some fortunate wins early in the season. You've banked those. You've banked those extra makes. You've banked those, New York has banked whatever teams have shot on open threes against them so far this season. So when the end of the season numbers come in, like, those will still be there. Those will still be a big chunk of their sample. But for the rest of the year, you would expect them to be about average. And so that's going to make their seasonal average kind of somewhere between the two.
Right. And like one way to think about this is last year, and I'm using Cleaning the Glasses version, the team that gave up the lowest opponent 3-point shooting percentage was the Toronto Raptors. They were at 34.3%. This year, the Toronto Raptors, and yes, their personnel is different, but this gets into the idea, league average 37.8, just a little bit stronger opponent shooting than league average. The Celtics have been kind of the question of whether that was going to, be the truism. And they did it. I mean, Indiana has flown pretty far from one direction to the other. Like, that's the whole point. It doesn't necessarily equalize over the course of a whole season, but it's still not predictive, especially moving forward.
Yes, I think that's a good way of putting it. So this is one of those things that you have to be very, very careful in how you say it. It can easily be interpreted as saying that defending the three-pointer isn't a thing. I don't think that's true. It's more that opponent percentage is not a great measure of how well you've done so for all these various reasons. I mean, I think just, you know, there are obviously good and bad ways to contest a shot. Like, on both ends of the bad ways, either you foul the guy, that's a terrible contest, or you're just nowhere near him and you leave him all alone and he has, you know, time to make a sandwich before he shoots, also terrible. On the other end is you block it, it has no chance of going in, that's great. And there's, you know, all sorts of gradations between there, and there's no reason not to believe that some teams and players are better at that than others. It's just that for any number of reasons, picking the signal of that skill out of the noise that is the percentage is basically impossible with the tools we have right now. So that tends to get the shorthand for that tends to be that, you know, defenses have no control over opponent 3-point percentage. And that's not totally true, but it's close enough to be true that we kind of start from there as our hypothesis.
Yeah, and that's why I think it's good to use, like, predictive as a word there, not necessarily like dispositive. Because, I mean, obviously, if you're, you know, the whole thing with, like, leaving the right guys open, I think the reason why, you know, because, like, that's something that comes up. I mean, this year it's been Knicks fans. It's been lots of people in other points in the years. 2 years ago, it was also Knicks fans, if memory serves. It might have been three. But it's the idea that, in the aggregate, when you're thinking about the large scale, teams don't do that enough for it to be predictive. And that's why, even though it isn't an absolute truism, you go that direction because it's more true than the alternative.
Yeah. Well, and it's and actually the funny thing is if you want to think of it, every team tries to leave the right guys open.
Yeah.
No team is like, you know, if Duncan Robinson's coming off a pin down, 29 teams in the league are trying to stay attached to his body. Duncan Robinson still gets shots off and still makes shots because he's good. So it's not just a matter of like, quote, leaving the right guys open. It's doing that demonstrably better than other teams. And there's very little evidence that's doable over a regular season. I think if we get into like a playoff situation, then that might change a little bit because then you can start to, like, you know, do more specific prep for kind of pet actions and stuff like that, which is that kind of prep is much more executable in a kind of a playoff setting where you're playing the same team a bunch and have, you know, some time to prep for them, both before the first game and between games.
Yeah, that's a great point. Shifting gears a bit, do you have more on this topic, or I was going to transition?
Oh, no.
Something that I've been thinking about a lot the last couple of weeks is, not everything is about the championship, but I enjoy thinking about title contenders, and I'm always a little bit reluctant to do too much on them in the early part of the season, just because it takes time to figure it out. We're focused more on, I'll use normal calendar dates, we're focused more on March and April than we are on December and January for that exact reason. And what has been interesting to me as I'm kind of like processing, well, who's tier one and all that type of stuff, is that other than the Jazz, we haven't really gotten particularly close, other than for maybe like a two or a three game stretch, I would say, to any of the real title contenders fastball. Like, we haven't seen that stretch of like, oh, this is what they're going to do, this is how they're going to crush everybody. And some of that is due to the unusual nature of this season, players being out, whether it's COVID or all these muscle injuries that are going on. And I actually am kind of excited by that. I think that it's going to make the second half of this season a lot more kind of stressful as an analyst, but it's also going to be fun to watch it kind of come together for, well, not everybody, but for as many teams as hopefully can.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. I think we've seen, like, you know, we've definitely seen stretches where the Lakers have looked pretty menacing. I think we've seen, you know, when, especially like before Jrue Holiday, like, missed all the games with the health and safety protocols. I think we really saw that from the Bucks. I don't know if we've really seen a run from the Clippers yet. I don't know if we've seen a run from the Nuggets. I don't know if we think of the Nuggets that way or not. In part because they haven't really done that yet. And like you say, the only other team that's kind of had that is I would say Philly. I think we've seen more of like the theory of the 76ers more than any other team but Utah.
Yeah, the Sixers are an interesting one. I haven't thought about them that way. I mean, they did have a lot of success, but it's funny, I don't. And sometimes this is the nature of when you watch a team and everything like that. Like those dominant wins. I remember I was impressed with how Embiid had a couple of big games against Boston early in the year, but Boston hasn't been exactly what we hoped and expected early on. I'm not writing them off in any way, shape, or form. But yeah, the other one for me is the Clippers. I mean, I would, off the top of my head, the time that was, and I'm looking briefly through their schedule, the time that I was most impressed with the Clippers was actually the first two games of the season when I thought they played the Lakers well, and then they faced the Nuggets a couple nights later and handled them.
Yeah, and, you know, I think everyone is, not everyone, but a lot of people are kind of, the Nuggets seem like, of the top teams, they're the one with a move to make. I think that, you know, you look at their team, you think of like a fourth quarter playoff lineup. I think they've got four guys you feel pretty good about, give or take Nick Batum, who in as kind of the third wing guy, actually seems like he makes a lot of sense. But you've got Ibaka, George, and Kawhi, and then Batum, and that's like okay, that's very switchable, versatile. Got plenty of shooting. Who's the fifth guy? Maybe in some matchups it's Pat Beverly.
And some it's Marcus Morris, but they don't have that clear cut. They don't have that clear cut fifth guy. It's an interesting concept. And I mean, and you could even have somebody like if you added that could, you know, knock Batum out or something else. But yeah. And I mean, part of why I've been, I mean, granted, I was plenty optimistic about the Clippers last year. That didn't work out super well. But I think that Ibaka, and we saw this at moments in time over this season, but not as consistently yet, that incidentally, I actually thought this, you saw this a little bit more in their loss to the Jazz than the win, was that he opens up some creative opportunities because Ibaka, you know, they don't have to switch everything. The Clippers can succeed in other ways. So maybe it ends up being at times a more conventional approach, but then you can space the four from the five, and then you get you get ancillary benefits with that in the first place.
Yeah, I don't know, but the thing, I mean, I don't know. Maybe to be cliche, it seems like the thing that the Clippers like you don't want to say they need a point guard, but it seems like someone who can kind of get them into some less heavy sledding offensive looks than, you know, Paul George and Kawhi can, you know, they can do that. They can create every shot. They can, whether it's for themselves or someone else, but it does seem like that's a little bit of pushing a sled uphill. Mm-hmm. Whereas just having a guy who can come down, run a pick and roll, you do some stuff, you're in your continuity and the offense happens and you can do that kind of autopilot for a couple minutes at a time. I want to say to not have the foot on the gas for your two main guys quite as much. And I think that would do well for them. And like their only option for that right now is Reggie Jackson. And
yeah. I think one way of kind of describing that is what's been going on with the Celtics this year, where Jason Tatum and Jaylen Brown have both taken big steps forward, but I still think the Celtics offense looks best when Kemba Walker can shoulder a larger part of the load. The offense just flows more naturally. Kemba he creates in a fundamentally different way. He's looking for teammates. It's creating better shots overall. And so while you want all of that and the gains that Jaylen Brown and Jason Tatum have made will benefit the Celtics when they're full strength and when they're not, I think about that sometimes with the Clippers, and it'll be fascinating to see, because remember, another part of this for everybody, especially in some ways for established stars, is not only about what the what's best for, like, if you're building a team in the abstract, it's also the human element here. And so I agree with you. I think that would really help them. But would Ty Lue empower that player? Would Paul George and Kawhi Leonard empower that player? I'm genuinely unsure. I'm not saying unsure like, oh, I'm skeptical those guys are jerks or something like that. It changes the way the ball flows. It changes the way the offense serves.
Yeah, I don't think we're not talking about like Chris Paul, someone who's just going to,
right.
who's going to be the little general out there, just someone who can, a professional point guard who can run a league average pick and roll four times in a row.
Yeah, and something that would be interesting for them, and there aren't too many of these players in the league, but there are a few, is somebody who's capable, but who is not so great that they have to be out there no matter what. Like, sure, if you can get somebody who's so great they'd be out there no matter what, that would be fantastic. But the Clippers don't have the means and the resources to do that because they have all of these.
Yeah,
they have all these first.
I was gonna say, do you have a name in mind?
I don't. Do you? Oh, I have one. I
forget. Yeah,
Patty Mills.
That's not the name I was expecting. Wow. Well, that would be interesting. Who was I? I feel like someone, I was having this conversation with someone and they floated George Hill. And I thought that was kind of like, and I think they're different, but kind of similar players in that way.
Well, what I like about Hill is that he's more what I would call reverse scalable, in the sense that if he doesn't have the ball as much, that's totally fine. Like, we've seen that at various moments in his career. Whereas Patty Mills, I think he functions better, not as an insanely high usage player, but, within the higher range of what you would want with Paul George and Kawhi.
Yeah, I think so. Like you said, of the sort of top tier contenders, like, they are the one that really seems like they maybe have something to get something done. And have a need. Like, I think that the Bucks could obviously use some depth, but they just, with the not even from an asset standpoint, just from a like cap legal perspective, like, they're so close to the hard cap that it's hard to find a way to make moves at all for anyone who's making any sort of money. So that even though it would be nice, it's just the mechanics are so much more difficult.
Yeah, and as we head into the trade deadline, and this is pretty consistently true for me, it's either the top-end buyers or this group of teams that have a little bit more nebulous ideas. I mean, we're seeing some of that with the Toronto Raptors, the reporting that is out there a little bit that maybe they're open to trading Kyle Lowry. I have posited that I actually think that's interesting, if true, because that is a preliminary indicator that maybe they're not going to re-sign Kyle Lowry, which I had thought, part of the reason you keep him is so that you can bring him back, though the cost of that might get high. But so you think about a team like Toronto or, let's say, Denver, where I think Denver could add. They have the means to do so. They have some intriguing young players. They have maybe not great filler salary, but they have players that make, modest amounts of money. And so I'm really interested in those sorts of teams, the ones that don't have to make a move but can make a move, what they end up deciding to do.
I mean, Denver's been crying out for a consolidation trade for how many years?
I think two or three.
Yeah. I mean, and this is, past results not guarantees of future performance, but if I'm them, I've kind of shown a track record of, I have three roster spots. Let me go find some guys who are NBA players, and they can do that. So trade, a couple, three guys for one higher end player, and then go find a couple more NBA players, and you still have 15. And that's it. And it just seems they have so consistently, hey, our RJ Hampton looks interesting. Zeke Nnaji, pretty interesting. Like, they just have those guys up and down their roster, and they have three point guards you can play. So I would be wanting to be so much more aggressive to try to find that, higher end person to like plug in, like, a higher end wing to start in place of Gary Harris, essentially.
And something that Denver has going for them is that they have some of those higher end players. So you're not expecting wing X to necessarily be your end all be all, because those type of players aren't truly available. But if it's somebody who can defend on the wing and hit open shots, which unfortunately Gary Harris is still having trouble with, then I think that it's still hard to get, and they might have to sacrifice some players that they like. But it is a worthwhile consideration at bare minimum.
I also think that, you know, if you're where Denver thinks they are, and where they've after kind of a rough start to the season, where they've kind of been, I think you kind of your value proposition changes. What it means to overplay pay for a player changes, because you care more about like who are the like what are the best five players we can put on the court.
Yeah, well, I think there was a FanGraphs piece on this a couple of years ago. It's like the last wins cost the most, and there's a reason for that. And whether that's that you have to overpay your players when you're already a good team, like the last guy gets more money because you have to keep him. Or just because, you know, in terms of treasure, in terms of assets it takes, that's just the way it works.
Yeah, and so there, I mean, and maybe this is just, you know, we thought they should have traded for Jrue Holiday last year, and they didn't. So maybe this conversation is residue of that a little bit, but still,
it could be.
I think they're that, yeah. And then can we talk about the flip side of that? How just like the fact that it's so compressed and the playing games. Like, you know, there's a lot of players on, say, the Bulls who would be interesting for a contender who just probably aren't available because the Bulls are right there.
Yeah, this is something like I was getting at. I was getting at that a little bit in my Sellers piece. It's like, what would selling look like? And then are these teams actually going to do it? Yeah, I mean, Thaddeus Young is a great example. I mean, the Bulls are such a weird case because their veterans have been some of their best players. And so, like, they've been... You know, they've been modestly successful, especially when healthy. But it's so interesting because, I mean, Zach LaVine notwithstanding, like, they've had a reasonable year, but I'm not feeling necessarily better other than LaVine about their young guys. But it's because they've, you know, like Porter, when he was healthy, was really helping them. Garrett Temple, when he's been available, has really helped them. And so, yeah, you're right. A lot of those guys could help another team.
But there's so many of those guys around the league that, like, you know, that's the kind of guy who would be a target at the deadline, and just because there's, you know, how many teams that are just, you know, sort of in the out of it but and okay with it position right now.
Yeah, like two or three. You know? And the other cruel twist of fate is that some of the players on teams either in that space or adjacent to it are players who make so much money that they're functionally untradeable. So, like, yeah, Blake Griffin, Al Horford, Andre Drummond, like, not that any of them are necessarily, like, I mean, Horford would help a team in a different way. But when you make that much money, it often is buyout or nothing because there just isn't another way to make a deal work.
Yeah, and that it became, and you and Nate talked about this, I think, is for, especially for a player like Griffin who has multiple years left, like, how much do you give back if you're Blake Griffin?
And how much do you demand back if you're the Pistons? Because there's no flexibility once you cut him. Like, this is the Nicola Batum situation, yeah, or Joe Noah with the Knicks and everything else. Once I actually wrote a piece for The Athletic that came out on Tuesday that's talking about this, is that dead money is one of the only things that's set in the league. And so once you have that, you can't do anything with it. And so there is a real cost to that from Detroit's perspective and everything else.
You wait for it to come off the books and then you trade for more salary to stretch.
That is a way to do. we're just about done, but I want to take do you want to talk a little bit about the analytics conference that's going on later this week?
Oh yeah. Thank you. Myself and some friends, Michael Lopez, who is the head of analytics for the NFL, the league office, Megan Chaka, who is the CEO of Stathletes, which is a hockey data company, and Allison Lucan, who is a wonderful hockey writer who weaves data in and out of her storytelling about as well as anyone around. We have put together kind of a two-day virtual conference where we're going to be discussing some topics in sports analytics with an emphasis, I would say, on communication and increasing access for people sort of newer to the field to kind of learn not just how to get a job, but how to do stuff. I think that there's plenty of advice out there on what you do if you want to get hired, but less so on how do I actually start to do analysis. And so that conference is going to be Thursday afternoon and all day Friday. It's called the Sports Ideas Symposium. You can find the website and sign up information and a list of speakers, including, I should add, the Evan Wash, who's the EVP at the NBA League office, who's in charge of of the NBA's kind of internal analytics arm is doing a fireside chat with our friend Ben Taylor, and I think that should be really interesting for basketball fans of all stripes. It's sportsideas.com, and we're charging $10 for admission. I think it's well worth it, and hopefully people can join.
Yeah, and I love the idea of making it affordable. I mean, I don't know if this is dream over the West, just to make it more accessible. And I mean, there has been a lot of discussion about gatekeeping in sports over the last few weeks, especially the last few days. And making good information and good insight available to people is extremely important.
No, and I think that was the impetus behind the four of us kind of getting together and deciding to plan it was exactly that, is to sort of remove barriers as much as possible and give people real access and insight as much as possible. And the one benefit of doing it in a virtual environment is that's a little bit less, a little bit more frictionless than it might be in an in-person.
Yeah, it doesn't have to be taking time off work or whatever and flying to a locale and trying to do all that. Yeah, it is much easier. And so yeah, I think it's a fantastic idea, and I'm so happy that you all are doing it.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it. It'll be a good time.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much for taking the time here. Pleasure as always.
Thanks a lot, Danny.
Thanks again so much to Seth Partnow for taking the time to come on. You can read his work at The Athletic. You can listen to the Nerder She Wrote podcast. You can follow Seth on Twitter at Seth Partnow, SethPartnow. And importantly, as long as you're listening to this before Thursday or Friday, you can check out the Sports Ideas Symposium. And if you want to get the full details, Seth went through it a little bit towards the end of the podcast, but you can also go to sports-ideas.com, sports-ideas.com, and check it out. Really great idea. Love the low price point as well. Barriers to entry are an extremely frustrating part of our business, and I love that they are doing something material to lower those barriers, which is fantastic. So thrilled about that. And you should definitely check it out if you have the time. If you want to support this show, there are a lot of ways you can do it. You can leave a rating, leave a review in the podcast player of your choice. That helps other people find the show. Also, word of mouth does the same thing. And you can subscribe, download every episode. Those are super important, whether it's Spotify, Apple Podcasts, wherever you get your podcasts, if you subscribe and download, because this show will never come out a specific day of the week or anything else, because it's about when I'm available and when my guests are available. So that allows you to get the episodes when they come in. And while this show is not intended to be super timely, that is part of my concept of Real GM Radio, still good to have them out there, and sometimes they are a little bit timely. I have a lot of other work going on too. Just had a new piece come out today for The Athletic, today meaning Tuesday, on a little nuance that I was interested in for the guarantee date deadline. That was fun. That's at The Athletic. Nate and I are doing Dunked On 5 days a week. One day is the public episode. That's typically a 15 and 60. It's actually going to be the top 10 prospects episode that we aired it for subscribers about a week ago, but that is going to be our all-star break episode. So everybody can get a chance to listen. We put so much time into that. It feels appropriate. And we're also still doing the NBA cast. That is a live broadcast of a game on League Pass. You can watch the game, which is so awesome, as Nate and I worked for years for the ability for you to not have to sync up or anything like that, to have it all on the same screen. And we will be doing that every Monday for the rest of the year. We, of course, will be taking the coming Monday off because there are no games, so we can't be doing a League Pass broadcast. But it will be back in full swing for the second half of the season. Also, we'll have plenty more content, including maybe, just maybe, something with Seth on the trade deadline, both before as a preview and analysis after the fact. So you can keep an eye out. That's a great reason to subscribe to The Athletic. If you have any feedback on the show, good, bad, or indifferent, DannyLarueNBA@gmail.com is the way to get it to me. If you take the time to write it, I will take the time to read it. That is a promise. That can be a guest suggestion. That can be anything. Honestly, it can be talk about this more, talk about this less, really whatever you want to do. And I'm trying to vary it up, trying to go some small team-specific stuff, some broad things, whole league-specific. That's just how I do the show. And hope you enjoy that. But if you don't, your feedback matters. This is a show that is about what guests are interested in, and also what I'm interested in to a point. So your input does really matter to me. And that's part of how I find great people to be on the show, is by saying, hey, you think this person would be good. I've gotten a few of those recently, and for those people who've sent them, I'm putting some work into that. We'll see if any of it bears fruit, but I hope that it does. So thank you so much for listening. Take care and make it a great day.